On a Thursday late in September, on the 22nd to be exact, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Robert McNamara, held a press conference in Washington in which he announced a 30% increase in the production of fighter and fighter-bomber aircraft during the next fiscal year. That same hour of that selfsame day, Ambassador Arthur Goldberg was speaking at the United Nations before the General Assembly and offering to that world body a broad program of a step-by-step de-escalation of the war in Vietnam and a negotiated settlement. As a first step, we were prepared to cease bombing Hanoi and North Vietnam if privately or otherwise, the North Vietnamese government would give an indication that they would take a corresponding reduction in their war effort. At the selfsame time, then, that Mr. McNamara was laying the groundwork for an extended and expanded war, Mr. Goldberg was saying, and I quote, "My government remains determined to exercise every restraint to limit the war and to exert every effort to bring the conflict to the earliest conclusion." Reading on the ticker tape of the International News Services these two reports, an Indian newspaper was moved to comment that it reminded them of those old-fashioned American Westerns in which a Sioux chief, beleaguered by land profiteers and poachers, about to be driven off his land to an enclosure, turns to the cavalry officer who has come to smoke the peace pipe, and he says, "White man, speak with forked tongue. White man, speak with forked tongue." Now, we in America emphasized the blessed words of peace. The Asians saw the bitter reality of war. And we have every reason to emphasize the words of peace. It took a very long time for our government even to consider publicly the possibility of a conference, of a settlement, to end this expedition into Asia. From our first involvement in South Vietnam until April of 1965, the government was not willing publicly, at least, to give credence to the proposition this war could be stopped short of the victory of the Saigon government, the total victory of that government over the Viet Cong. Typically, in October of 1963, a White House statement said, "We will adhere to our policy of working with the people and the government of South Vietnam to deny their country to communism and to suppress the externally stimulated and supported insurgency of the Viet Cong as promptly as possible." Now, these were the years in which Washington could still promise the American people that our troops would be home by Christmas. These were the years in which Washington still seemed to believe that the Viet Cong were nothing more than the advance guard of the North Vietnamese Army, a few tens of thousands of insurrectionists who had infiltrated across the border and who could be militarily disposed of. And these were the years in which Washington seemed to believe that the government in Saigon was the official government of all of the South Vietnamese people. It represented something more than a military junta supported by our arms and our monies, which had somehow fought its way to official position. Then came the bitter disillusionment, the growing casualty lists, the escalating war, the failure of the rural pacification programs, The visible evidence that the Saigon military government was not a popular government, the Buddhist revolts, the revolt of the northern cities, dissidents among the Montagnards, the hill peoples. The American people became more sophisticated about the facts of this faraway, until then little-known nation. The American people began to demand of Washington a clearer statement of principles. Why had we been brought to Southeast Asia in the first place, against competent military advice? What were we doing there? How long would we remain? Was this a new commitment of American power across 5,000 miles of water to a continent of almost 2 billions of people? To clear the American mind and to justify his position, the President of the United States at the Johns Hopkins University on the 7th of April of 1965 made an important speech in which he made it clear that the United States had no imperial designs in Asia. We wanted no military bases, no economic advantage. And in which he said, inter alia, the only path for reasonable men is the path of settlement. And he said also, we remain ready for unconditional discussions. Now, an American people which has never looked on its government as truculent or belligerent, American government which has never assumed the ambitions of the nations to be imperial, this American people was delighted to hear the government speak of limited ambitions, of a limited program, of the possibility of ending the war by conference and by negotiation. And when Washington began to spell out the terms of these negotiations, we began to feel that they were fairly generous, hopeful. January of this year, the State Department issued what it called a basket of peace. This is simply a cover term for 14 statements which have been made by official representatives of the government about the terms of a possible conference or settlement. And they read as follows. 1. The Geneva Agreements of 1954 and 1962 are an adequate basis for peace in Southeast Asia. 2. We would welcome a conference in Southeast Asia or any part thereof. 3. We would welcome negotiations without preconditions, as the request of the 17 nations put to us put it. 4. We would welcome unconditional discussions, President Johnson has put it. 5. A cessation of hostilities could be the first order of business at a conference, or could be the subject of preliminary discussions. 6. Hanoi's 4 points could be discussed along with other points which others might wish to propose. 7. We want no United States bases in Southeast Asia. 8. We do not desire to retain United States troops in South Vietnam after peace is assured. 9. We support free elections in South Vietnam to give the South Vietnamese a government of their own choice. 10. The question of reunification of Vietnam should be determined by the Vietnamese through their own free elections. 11. The countries of Southeast Asia can be non-aligned or neutral if that be their option. 12. We would much prefer to use our resources for the economic reconstruction of Southeast Asia than in war. If there is peace, North Vietnam could participate in a regional effort to which we would be prepared to contribute at least $1 billion. 13. The President has said, quote, the Viet Cong would not have difficulty being represented and having their views represented if for a moment Hanoi decided she wanted to cease aggression. I do not think that would be an insurmountable problem, end of quote. And lastly, we have said publicly and privately that we could stop the bombing of North Vietnam as a step towards peace, although there has not been the slightest hint or suggestion from the other side as to what they would do if the bombing stopped. In summation, we have put everything into the basket of peace except the surrender of South Vietnam. Now, the American people as a whole were delighted to hear these words from the administration and a willingness to go along. Well, the administration's actions began to grow in evidence in the United States. For our involvement in Southeast Asia, I firmly believe, has never been a popular one. We seem to have fallen into it. People say to me, I don't know why we are there, but I am sure that the administration must have some good reason for being there. In any case, once we had proposed what seemed to be honorable and generous terms, the American people seemed to rally behind the administration and to say, the shoe now is on the other foot. What more can we do? And when Hanoi curtly and contemptuously dismissed these 14 points and every other proposal of peace made from Washington, the American people began to say, perhaps the administration was right all along in warning us about the cold-eyed contempt of these fanatic ideologues for human life and world peace. Perhaps they are so determined to gain their ends by force and by aggression and subversion that we have no alternative but to fight a messy and unwanted war. Perhaps. Now I wonder. My mind keeps coming back to the Indian editorial, which assumes that the white man speaks with a forked tongue. I wonder if Hanoi and Asia and perhaps the world do not have good reason to be suspicious of these so-called proposals of settlement. My mind runs back to some rather recent history. The end of the Second World War, the United States at Tehran and again at San Francisco pledged itself to the principle of the self-determination of nations, the end of colonialism, the independence of the nations of the world. And a year later, when France deposed the new Democratic Republic of Vietnam, an independent republic which had grown on the ruins of the Japanese governing of the country during the war, when France simply reimposed her colonial rule and her puppet king Bao Dai, the United States made not a protest. And when the officials of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, communist and non-communist alike, went into exile and began to fight a covert guerrilla war for independence, a war which ended with the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu and the Geneva Conference of 1954, the United States proved its word at Tehran and San Francisco by supporting the French colonial arms to the tune of 80% of the cost of that military undertaking. And when the world insisted that this bloody fight between France and her once colonial possession must end and brought that war to an end at Geneva in 1954, the United States sat as a member of that conference until the final treaty was drawn and then withdrew, refused to sign the protocol, a protocol which spoke of a temporary partitioning of Vietnam, North and South, which insisted that a plebiscite elections must be held within 2 years as to the possibility of reunification. And the United States set about undermining this international convention by encouraging the desires of Diem to have a fully independent, a permanently independent nation, South Vietnam, and encouraged him in his contemptuous dismissal of the 1956 elections, which he simply refused to hold. I wonder if the white man has indeed spoken with a forked tongue. In 1965, in April, when the president spoke at the Johns Hopkins, and said that the only path to reasonable men is the path of settlement, and we remain ready for unconditional discussions. There were 30,000 American troops in South Vietnam. Now, I'm sure Hanoi's heard these words, but I'm also sure that Hanoi watched the largest debarkation of American expeditionary forces in South Vietnam the following month of any month up to that time. 18 months ago, when the president first spoke of settlement, there were 30,000 American troops in South Vietnam. 18 months later, when Mr. Goldberg speaks of settlement, there are 331,000 American troops in South Vietnam, and 44,500 South Korean troops, and 4,500 Australian and New Zealand troops, and another 30,000 American troops in Thailand manning the bases from which we bomb North Vietnam, and 45,000 American sailors and airmen with the aircraft carriers and the ships of the 7th Fleet. Hanoi hears the words of peace but sees the bitter facts of an escalated war. Hanoi heard Mr. Goldberg speak of America's desire for peace and offered what seems to be a generous proposal. We will stop the bombing the minute we hear that Hanoi is prepared to restrict its war effort. We will withdraw our troops as Hanoi withdraws her troops. We will withdraw our troops totally when Hanoi has withdrawn its troops totally, and we will go to the conference table to end the war. But Hanoi also heard and saw and suffered that very same week the most devastating air attack of the war, an attack larger in scope and more destructive in its power than any that was raised against Nazi Germany during the entire course of the Second World War. Does the white man speak with a forked tongue? There has appeared recently a very disconcerting book. It's entitled The Politics of Escalation in Vietnam. It's the work of a group of professors at Washington University in St. Louis and at the University of California in Berkeley. These men are historians and political scientists and experts, some of them in Far Eastern history. And they have, as academicians, made a careful search of all that has become public knowledge about the international negotiations of the past 2 years. And it is their sobering conclusion that when the pressure has mounted, domestically or internationally, for negotiations, the American government has always responded with a significant escalation of the war. And they raise the possibility that we have used the talk of peace as a camouflage and a prelude to such escalation. As an example, one example among 12 that they cite. In June of this past year, there were Canadian and French intermediaries, official representatives of those two governments in Hanoi, trying to mediate this conflict and to bring it to an end. Apparently, both of these groups wired back to their capitals that there were some hopeful signs of a willingness by Hanoi to come to the conference table. That very same June week, the President of the United States said, "We must continue to raise the cost of aggression at its source," and he ordered the bombing of industrial targets in the suburbs of Haiphong and of Hanoi. I do not know if the well-documented thesis of this book is, in fact, the full story. But I do know that it makes disconcerting reading to an American who has been trained to believe that his government means what it says and that it is fundamentally committed to the cause of peace in our world. But this aside, all the cynicism which an Asian might have about American protestations of peace aside, as American citizens, we can well ask, so what? Perhaps we have not always lived up to our word, but This is our word now. We have stated it publicly in the Forum of the Nations. We could not go back on it. If the Asians, if Hanoi believes it to be a bluff, why don't they take us up on the bluff? What have they got to lose? The terms are generous. What have they got to lose? I'd like to suggest to you this morning the terms of peace which we have offered are not as disingenuous and as generous as they at first reading seem to be. I'd like to suggest to you that the terms of settlement which we have so far stipulated, in fact, insist that the United States will win at the conference table what we have not so far been able to win on the battlefield. And that is the integrity of South Vietnam under the unquestioned, unopposed control of the Saigon government. In all of our statements about settlement and conference and negotiation and peace, one theme is clear. The president said it 18 months ago at the Johns Hopkins. Our objective is the independence of South Vietnam and its freedom from attack. Peace demands an independent South Vietnam, securely guaranteed and able to shape its own relationships to all others. The State Department basket of speech of peace listing, which I read to you, remember, ends with these words. In other words, we have put everything in the basket of peace except the surrender of South Vietnam. Now, Arthur Goldberg, speaking just a month ago at the United Nations, said it somewhat more diplomatically, but said it nevertheless. The essential facts of the Vietnam conflict can be stated briefly. Vietnam today remains divided along the demarcations lines agreed upon in Geneva in 1954. To the north and south of that line are North Vietnam and South Vietnam. Provisional though they may be, pending a decision on the peaceful reunification of Vietnam by the process of self-determination, they are nonetheless political realities in the international community. What we have in mind and the proposals that we have made so far is this. There will be a Korean-like settlement, 17th parallel instead of the 38th parallel. As Hanoi withdraws the North Vietnamese troops and the Viet Cong to the north, we will withdraw our troops to the ocean, back to our own continent. What does that leave? It leaves a South Vietnam empty of troops, except for the troops of the Saigon government. That leaves half the population of South Vietnam, which has supported the Viet Cong and apparently still supports it, at the mercy of a Saigon military junta, which has been known once or twice to use intimidation and terror to achieve its own political ends. It achieves the very thing that we set about in 1954 to do, to subvert the Geneva Conference and to bring about a permanently independent nation, South Vietnam, whose interest, economic and otherwise, will be towards the West. And Ho Chi Minh knows this well. He remembers the fiasco of the never-held election in 1956. He has only to look at Korea or at Germany to know that all the verbiage about a possible plebiscite sometime in the nebulous future are mere words. That partitions once drawn are not easily erased and undone. And he knows that what America will have achieved by such an offer of peace is no more than she seeks to achieve and cannot achieve now on the battlefield. We would, in effect, be placing the South Vietnamese people under the full control of the Saigon government, which has never been popularly mandated, which has in opposition not only the Viet Cong, communists and otherwise, but many groups of dissidents who are not members of the Viet Cong. Saigon would have all the arms. The others would be unarmed. One wonders at the kind of democracy which would be practiced in that little nation. I can never erase from my mind the evidence of such Asian democracy, which I heard and saw in Korea. As our troops, as the Marines moved north, We recaptured villages. We would hear from time to time gunfire in our rear. And we would send out patrols afraid that the enemy had come from behind. And we would discover that the Republic of Korean troops, our allies, had moved into the village and had lined up any and all opposition to Mr. Syngman Rhee and had shot them down in cold blood. The Asian terms of politics are not our own, yet they must be considered if we consider a political solution to Southeast Asia. I'm afraid that the terms of peace which we have so far offered are not terms of peace, but terms of victory. That all they offer to North Vietnam is a cessation of bombing. They are a face-saving device, and nothing more. Can peace come to the middle, to the Far East? I believe it can. And I believe that the withdrawal of troops north and to the east, the American mainland into North Vietnam, is a prerequisite for such a peace. But I believe that we must go much further than this. I believe what we must propose to the world, not only that the North Vietnamese withdraw their 17 battalions, and that we withdraw our troops 10 times that strength, but that we disarm all of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, the Buddhists, the bandit groups, and the army of South Vietnam and its police force. Only if we disarm all of these groups can their vindictive political vendettas be brought from the battlefield into the political arena in the ballot box. But a nation cannot simply be disarmed. There must be a police force. Someone must protect its borders. And so you have to encourage and probably to subsidize a United Nations force or some other neutralist force coming into this area to act as a guard during this period of time. There must be withdrawal and the cessation of fighting, but there must also be the disarmament of the entire South Vietnamese nation. And with that disarmament goes the implied statement, the government of Saigon is not necessarily the legitimate government of South Vietnam. Arthur Goldberg suggested this in one cryptic aside, which we need to enlarge upon. He said to the United Nations, nor do we seek to exclude any segment of the South Vietnamese people from peaceful participation in their country's future. What I am suggesting are the techniques by which alone this can be achieved. Withdrawal, disarmament, the presence of a peacekeeping United Nations force, and then a timetable for a plebiscite on reunification. And yes, the recognition that in all probability this plebiscite will vote for reunification. There are more to the north and to the south in South Vietnam. But let us now at least count on the growing nationalism of the Asians as we have counted on the growing nationalism of the Europeans to act as buffers and satellites between the great powers of the world. We've learned to live with Tito and Yugoslavia, with Poland, with Hungary, and with Romania, communist states all. Why cannot we in Asia learn to live with certain neutralist or at least non-aggressive communist states which act as a buffer zone between our interests and those of China and those of Russia? Withdrawal, an end to the fighting. Disarmament, an end to the internal bickering. The presence of a United Nations force and a plebiscite for reunification. Now, this is not the glory road. There's no victory for the United States here. We will, in the end, lose South Vietnam. But we will have peace. And a policy which we undertook in haste and without really thinking through its ramifications, policy which was born in confusion and bred in fear, we cannot expect such a policy to redound to the glory of our escutcheon, the gain of victory for us. We came into Southeast Asia with blindness ignorance and fear. We remained in Southeast Asia because we did not have in those early years the courage to cut our commitments, to understand the full complexity of the Asian picture. We remained in Asia because we continued to have an overly simple view of what was happening in Vietnam. Saigon was a legitimate government. Viet Cong was a group of communist insurgents. Saigon was only a semi-legitimate government. And the Viet Cong was not only a group of communist insurrectionists and subversives, but a broadly based revolution against Saigon. Simplifying what we saw, we came to simple answers. And there are no simple answers in Asia. There is no simple way to peace in Asia. At the beginning, there's an admission on our part that we cannot gain victory through negotiations, that all we can gain is peace. And the way to peace is, in my humble estimation, withdrawal, disarmament, the United Nations presence, and a timetable, a guaranteed timetable for the plebiscite on reunification. What will we have when it is all over? Very little more than we had in Southeast Asia 20 years ago. Will we have an independent South Vietnam? Probably not. Will we have a freedom-loving, democratic Vietnam, North and South? Surely not. We ought not be too quick to read off these semi-communist nations as irrevocable enemies of the United States. Indonesia is an example which must be borne in mind. These nations are nations. They are groups of people with their own ambitions. And their ambitions are not necessarily those of China or Russia or of the Comintern ideological position. I see no victory in Asia. See only the dim hope that we may be able to reestablish the precarious peace which this world requires. And the way of peace is the way of negotiation. Negotiation implies not winning your point, but bargaining with a man across the table from you, so that each of you can step away from the competition, from the battle, with some degree of honor and self-respect. Happy at least that you have contributed some share to stability in our world. We read this morning in our service, O Lord, God of all the world, show thou the pathway of peace unto all the children of men. View them with a desire for brotherliness and goodwill, which alone can bring enduring peace. May the nations realize that the triumphs of war turn to ashes, and that justice and righteousness are better than conquest and dominion. For it is not by might, nor by power, but by thy spirit, the blessings of peace can be made secure. May the nations realize the triumphs of war turn to ashes, and that justice and righteousness are better than conquest and dominion, that it is not by might and not by power, but by thy spirit, that peace and hope can come into our world for the benefit of all mankind. Amen.